It would melt the permafrost. It would create an uphills and downhills running slurry. The pipe would lose support and likely break.
How the burgeoning environmental movement shaped the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, July 6th. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, the conversation continues over oil and gas tax credits. But is it going anywhere?
And what we've learned is that that's not really a doable proposal, that it would be very difficult, if not impossible, to implement.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
And by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The remains of two people missing since last week from a capsized boat near Kodiak were located this Tuesday. Last week, the fishing vessel Miss Destiny capsized in Marmot Bay. Two crew members were rescued by a Good Samaritan vessel, but two others could not be found. The Coast Guard searched the area for more than 35 hours before suspending efforts late Friday night. On the 4th of July, a salvage company righted the vessel and towed it to Kodiak Harbor. There, the troopers, the Kodiak City Fire Department, and the Coast Guard Marine Safety Detachment recovered the remains of the two missing people. Troopers have identified the deceased as 18-year-old Joshua Osborne and 22-year-old Abigail Osborne, both from Wasilla. According to a trooper dispatch, a rogue wave struck the Miss Destiny on the port side and knocked it over. The two people who were in the upper wheelhouse managed to escape and cling onto a skiff that had been stuck on deck. Last December, Mark and Cecilia Matter lost their lives when their plane crashed into Marvel Dome, a snow-covered mountain near the family's mine. Authorities now consider the Aniak couple's death to be a suicide. KYUK's Teresa Katsourilis reports.
According to a report released by the National Transportation Safety Board, or NTSB, authorities couldn't find any mechanical issues with the Matter's plane that could have caused the accident. The report concludes that Mark Matter must have crashed the plane intentionally.
Unfortunately, there's no winners in this one. We feel for the family.
Clint Johnson is a spokesperson for the NTSB. He says his agency followed the state troopers' lead in this case. They conducted their own investigation. According to Alaska Dispatch News, friends and family told the troopers that Cecilia Matter was sick with cancer at the time of the crash. In a past interview with KYUK, the Matter's children said that their mother didn't have long to live. Johnson says that in his experience, suicides by plane are rare.
You know, my 20 years, I think there's probably been roughly three. We've always had, suspicions maybe, but obviously the ones that we were able to rule were suicide are very, very, very few.
The Matter's children declined requests for further comment. In a previous interview, they told KYUK that their parents were inseparable. I'm Teresa Katsourilis.
It's been 2 weeks since most state lawmakers left Juneau after passing the operating budget, but the legislature's special session hasn't ended. And while senators plan to return on Monday, it's not clear whether the Senate and House will reach any agreements before the session ends on July 15th. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
Many lawmakers wanted to get out of Juneau after they voted to pass the budget. And while Governor Bill Walker asked them to consider a bill changing oil and gas taxes shortly after the budget vote, they still decided to leave. There have been no public meetings on the legislation, House Bill 111. But Democratic Representative Chris Tuck says the House didn't formally adjourn because majority caucus members still wanted to make changes to oil and gas taxes.
We weren't going to pull the rug out of underneath the governor adding to the call, House Bill 111. It's something that we're very passionate about.
Without any public progress on the bill, lawmakers have just met in technical sessions, which prevented them from adjourning the special session. But there are too few lawmakers present to take any official action. The oil and gas tax bill is the only item on the agenda. And while the Senate majority wants to pass a version of the bill that ends a type of oil and gas tax credit, House members say they want a broader compromise. Anchorage Democratic Representative Garen Tarr says the Senate proposal to end oil and gas tax credits that can be cashed in, retroactive to July 1st, isn't realistic.
And what we've learned is that that's not really a doable proposal, that it would be very difficult, if not impossible, to implement a mid-year tax change like that. And so I'm not sure if it was a just a political gimmick or if it was really a serious proposal.
The legislature also hasn't agreed on a capital budget. The state could lose out on federal money for roads if it doesn't pass a capital budget by the end of September. It's not clear when lawmakers plan to take up the capital budget again, or if Walker will add it to this special session or to a third special session later this year. Lawmakers also haven't passed a plan to balance the state's budget in the long term. Instead, the legislature voted to spend $2.5 billion from a piggy bank, the Constitutional Budget Reserve. That reserve doesn't have enough money to cover a similar draw next year. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Governor Bill Walker has appointed Hollis French to lead a state agency that oversees oil and gas production and enforces industry safety rules. French took over as chair of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission on July 1st and will serve a four-year term. He's replacing Kathy Forrester, who served the previous four-year term as chair and is still on the commission. French also has a long history, political history, in Alaska. Most recently, he ran for lieutenant governor in 2014, along with Democratic nominee Byron Mallott, before Mallott merged his campaign with Walker. French also served as a Democratic member of the Alaska Senate for 12 years. French has experience in the oil industry. Before becoming a lawyer in 1995, he worked for ARCO and Shell in Alaska. It's been a slow wildfire season so far. As of this morning, just over 200,000 acres have burned from 273 different fires, which, according to Tim Mowry, spokesman for the State Division of Forestry, puts 2017 well below normal.
In a typical season, we average about 1.2 million acres a year and about 500 fires.
Mowry cautions that at this time last year, even less acreage had burned, but then came an uptick in activity that boosted the total. While that could still happen this year, Mowry says that normally mid-July trends towards cooler, wetter weather. As a result, Alaska wildfire fighting agencies are ramping down suppression operations across large parts of the state. Mowry says aviation resources are already being downsized.
The two big scoopers, the CL-415s from the U.S. Forest Service that have been up here, were released, so they'll be heading south.
Mowry says the state is hanging on to smaller water scooping planes, retardant tankers, and helicopters for a while longer. And Alaska firefighting personnel have yet to be made available for lower 48 assignments. Wrangell officials have pulled out of contract talks between the union representing municipal workers and the borough manager. Interim borough manager Carol Rushmore posted a letter on the municipal website Wednesday evening stating she had decided not to accept the union's most recent proposal. She added that the borough would not make any counteroffers to International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers members that could lead them to go back on strike. 24 utility and other workers went on strike June 22nd after the union and municipality rejected each other's final contract offers. Another 35 management and non-union employees remain on the job. Officials from the borough and the union resumed negotiations June 29th. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, revitalizing Tlingit language learning in Juneau.
And I wanted to learn more and more and more. So far, it's amazing. I really love the class.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Midnight Oil is brought to you with generous support from the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
In the late 1960s, Alaskans knew the oil potential of Prudhoe Bay, and the oil companies knew they needed a pipeline to get that oil to market. For that, the U.S. government had to issue permits to use the land. Permission might have been quickly granted, but just as this was happening, the environmental movement was taking hold in America. With the pipeline turning 40 this summer, reporter Liz Ruskin looks back at how Big Green fought Big Oil, how that fight transformed the pipeline, and why Congress agreed to it at all.
Sections of 48-inch pipe were already en route to Alaska when an attorney in Washington, D.C. named Jim Moorman got a call. It was the founder of Friends of the Earth asking if he could stop the pipeline. Moorman said he'd heard of the project. He'd read a newspaper article that made the pipeline sound like a horror show.
It would melt the permafrost. It would create an uphills and downhills running slurry. The pipe would lose support and likely break. And the article suggested they had just then moved the pipe to the next valley and it'd all start over again. It was a very alarming article.
So the attorney looked for anything he could use to prevent this disaster. And he didn't find much. In 1969, there were very few environmental laws, none that really applied to this situation. Government could essentially permit a pipeline of whatever quality it deemed fit. Then, Moorman says, a gift from Capitol Hill.
Shortly after the first of the year in 1970, I learned that Congress had enacted a new law, the National Environmental Policy Act.
These days, every bureaucrat knows the law. You can find it on YouTube.
The National Environmental Policy Act, known as NEPA.
NEPA requires disclosure of the environmental consequences of a proposed project.
NEPA was the first major environmental law in the United States.
Today, NEPA is a big deal. It requires an environmental impact statement for major projects that would alter the physical landscape. It allows ordinary people the opportunity to influence a project. And it's been used as a tool for delay in court. But when Congress passed NEPA in late 1969, the talk was all lofty about making environment a national priority. The nuts and bolts of it, they were kind of beside the point. So it almost went unnoticed that the new law required federal agencies to write a, quote, detailed statement for each project it considers. But Jim Moorman, the environmental lawyer, he noticed.
Well, that was a bit of a bombshell for me.
That detailed statement, though? Nobody knew what that meant exactly, or if the courts would enforce it. But Moorman's clients, Friends of the Earth, the Wilderness Society, and the Environmental Defense Fund, wanted to stop the pipeline, and they thought this new law could help. In the spring of 1970, when the government was ready to issue permits, Moorman asked the Interior Department for its detailed statement on the pipeline. What Moorman got back, the document that was supposed to list all the environmental effects of this Trans-Alaska endeavor, was just 8 pages.
I've had this in the files ever since the case.
8 pages for 800 miles. Moorman sued the feds, arguing the 8-page statement didn't comply with NEPA. The attorney remembers being nervous when the case went to court. In Alaska, workers were literally unloading pipe in the port of Valdez. But then they won. The judge agreed the government's impact statement was inadequate. Moorman brought the largest project in Alaska history to a halt.
This is a little corny. I had a moment of euphoria. The only other time I've had such a feeling of euphoria is when I got married.
Moorman's lawsuit forced the oil companies to spend 3 more years and a small fortune on engineering analysis and documentation. Gone was the idea of just putting a hot pipe in frozen ground. Engineers got to work designing elevated sections, insulated sections, sections on sliders so the pipe could flex in an earthquake. In 1971, Senator Ted Stevens told reporters that Congress, by passing NEPA, had forced them into a strange new set of procedures.
The final environmental impact statement filed by Interior on the Alaska pipeline must be so complete as to be able to withstand any legal attack.
This was the birth of the encyclopedic environmental impact statement we know today. The government held hearings on the pipeline in Anchorage and Washington. Several thousand people testified or submitted comments, most of them against the project. You can practically hear the bureaucracy's head exploding at the work it took just to listen to the public.
Sitting in front of me is a set of transcripts from the Washington hearings.
That's Interior official Jack Horton in 1971, with a stack of papers about 6 inches high.
What you're seeing there is approximately 1/9 of the total paperwork that the department will have to go through very thoroughly.
The final environmental impact statement stretched to 9 volumes. Proponents said no project in American history had ever been so thoroughly scrutinized. The Interior Department announced in the spring of 1972 it would grant permits. And the environmentalists? They went back to court. It was now clear to pipeline proponents that the lawsuit could drag on for years. Some lawmakers decided there was no time to let the NEPA challenge play out in court. Alaska's Senator Mike Gravel was one of them. He's intensely proud of his work in 1973 to convince Congress to allow the pipeline.
It was the most significant economic decision and a political decision since statehood itself. Nothing compares to it.
He cast himself as a maverick of the Senate. Senator Ted Stevens used to complain he was a showboat. Alaska's two senators kind of hated each other. Gravel could be a show-off, but he got the job done on this one. Here's how. There were bills to authorize the pipeline in both the House and Senate. Gravel wrote an amendment that said NEPA's requirements had been met. That would have ended the lawsuit. Alaska Congressman Don Young, then in his freshman year, says Gravel was just trying to steal victory for himself.
I thought he threatened the pipeline. He didn't care with publicity.
Young and Stevens thought they could get the NEPA waiver through the House bill and avoid a public vote on it in the Senate. Because doing an end run around NEPA, it was very controversial. If Gravel lost the vote, that could have killed it. And then there might never have been a Trans-Alaska pipeline. In the end, the Senate vote was dead even. Vice President Spiro Agnew broke the tie. Young doesn't argue with Gravel's success.
He lucked out and became a hero, and God bless him.
But even then, the bill might not have made it to the president's desk if it weren't for world events.
This is NBC Nightly News, Wednesday, October 17th.
Good evening. The oil-producing countries of the Arab world decided to use their oil as a political weapon.
The Arab oil embargo. It made an existing fuel shortage worse and jacked up the price of gas. With the country in crisis, America decided it really did want Alaska's oil. In Congress, the last opposition to the Alaska pipeline disappeared. The final bill passed with huge margins, and President Richard Nixon signed it into law in November 1973, clearing the way for construction to begin. The result of that long fight is a pipeline that's considered a wonder of engineering. And maybe the Trans-Alaska pipeline would have been well-engineered anyway, but it was NEPA and that lawsuit that forced the oil companies and the government to prove it. With help from Rasha McChesney, I'm Liz Ruskin.
This story is part of the Alaska Energy Desk's new podcast, Midcast Oil. You should subscribe. You can do it at our website, alaskapublic.org, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The Sealaska Heritage Institute recently published the Beginning Tlingit Workbook. It's part of an ongoing effort to revitalize Tlingit and is free online. KTOO's Carter Barrett visited a Juneau Public Library workshop to learn about the language and the workbook.
This isn't a class, and there is no teacher. About 15 people are participating in a Tlingit language learning workshop at the library. The group of natives and non-natives are learning a language that only around 100 people speak fluently. The non-structured workshop works the complicated sounds and structure of the Tlingit language. On this particular night, they are using pages from the workbook to teach different greetings and responses.
No. I don't think there's really an emphasis.
Well, it's not so much emphasis as it is
I spoke with a few of the people there. Daniel Hernandez was fascinated with the few Tlingit words he learned in his training as a seasonal tour guide in Juneau. He's made going to the Monday night workshop part of his routine.
The information that I got briefed on just really started to fascinate me, so I wanted to learn more. And I wanted to learn more and more and more. So far, it's amazing. I really love the class. Yeah, I'm really learning a lot.
Quinne Lance Twitchell authored the workbook. He's a fluent Tlingit speaker and professor at the University of Southeast Alaska. I got in touch with him while he was teaching a culture camp in Yakutat. He's been at the forefront of revitalizing the Tlingit language, which was nearly destroyed through colonialist efforts that forbid Native children from speaking their language.
If Tlingit is gone, and if nobody's teaching it, then you have a total assimilation and a total linguistic and cultural genocide because people came and attacked this language and really tried to remove it.
The workbook is an extension of The Beginning Tlingit Book by Richard and Nora Dauenhauer and uses a lot of illustrations and pictures to help teach the language.
It would be strange to think to go live in some rural part of France or something and just go spend my life there and never learn the language. But you can expect that in indigenous areas, and that's part of the sort of colonial mindset.
So on the front of this, you'll see forming Tlingit questions.
Twitchell hopes that in 30 years, there will be around 5,000 fluent Tlingit speakers. In Juneau, I'm Carter Barrett.
The summer season for the commercial Dungeness crab fishery in southeast Alaska will be 3 weeks shorter than usual, closing on July 25th. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game made the announcement last week after tallying the harvest from the first 7 days of the crab season. The catch from that first week came in at 605,000 pounds. Joe Stratman is the state's lead crab biologist for the southeast region.
I would say it's unprecedented. It's only the second time we've come in under threshold. It's the largest reduction we've made to the fishing time for the summer season.
The summer crab season was shortened once before in 2013, but only by 1 week, not three. An estimate of 2.25 million pounds is what's needed to keep the season open the full 2 months. The current estimate for the combined summer and fall harvest is 1.68 million pounds. Alaska's Bristol Bay sockeye fishery is intense, lucrative, and also remote. Much of the fish landed there is frozen whole and shipped long distances for secondary processing. Although the product is famous, there are some who think the quality could be improved. In Sitka, a pair of entrepreneurs is betting $2 million that they can deliver a better Bristol Bay sockeye. Meet Northline Seafoods. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The relentless pace of sockeye fishing can't be overstated. Two openings a day, 4 hours between openings, with harvests topping 13 million pounds a day during the peak of the season in June. 12 processors buy fish in Bristol Bay, and next year there will be a 13th. Northline.
There'll be three more of these ice machines when we get done.
This is Pat Glob, who, with his partner Ben Blakey, has bought a 150-foot former helicopter logging barge and is converting it into a floating fish processor. When it's done, this facility will be able to freeze up to 300,000 pounds of whole sockeye a day while tied to the banks of the Ugashik River, about 85 miles south of Naknek, where the nearest processors are located. But right now, these guys are over 800 miles away from Bristol Bay in a makeshift office aboard the barge moored at Sitka's Industrial Park. Any other year, both Blakey and Glob would be fishing in Bristol Bay now instead of building a seafood plant. Blakey has leased out his boat for the summer.
I spent pretty much every summer in Bristol Bay since I was a kid. That's actually where I met Pat.
So, yeah, we met as we're fishing partners when we both started fishing in the bay many, many years ago.
Their idea is simple. Ice where it's needed. The length of time a Bristol Bay sockeye spends in the hold of a gillnetter until it's delivered to a tender or processor is highly variable. Some fishing boats are equipped to refrigerate seawater to cool down their catch. Most are not. Blakey and Glob want to close that gap.
There's a real need in the bay for chilled fish. There's nobody in the world that wouldn't say that there isn't a portion of that fleet that hasn't the ability to take care of these fish properly. We feel this thing will fill that need.
Pat Glob is a self-taught engineer and one of Alaska's most prolific seafood plant builders. This barge is actually his 11th processor. Technically a tender, this barge will operate with around 20 people as opposed to the 200 or so needed to run a processor on shore.
There's a lot of communities in Alaska that can't really support a full-time cannery or a processor with that many people because they don't have enough volume. If a outfit like this can get by with less overhead and lower labor costs, they might be able to, you know, park it in front of a more isolated area.
The barge has four levels. Topmost is the former helipad, which will be used for net storage. Below that are the offices and crew quarters. On deck, Glob's crew is installing evaporators for the huge freezers, and there is a large area with cranes for offloading fish. Below decks is a massive compressor, one of three planned, and holding tanks for fish and frozen slush. Glob will test the barge's processing capability right here later this summer on pink salmon, around 90,000 pounds a day. In the fall, he'll haul out the barge on a ramp that the industrial park has authorized him to build on his leased land and prep the hull for its voyage to Bristol Bay next spring. The labor on the barge will be devoted to sorting the fish by quality, and that's where Glob hopes to find a premium price.
What we want to do is we want to dump them out, take a good look at them, right? Even pull three fish out and check them and make sure they test out. And if they don't test out, we can call them aside. And it's not a punishment to the fishermen. It's feedback for the fishermen and not punishing our market, who will get those randomly if I just dump them in as they're doing now, right?
This is what Glob thinks will be the game changer for Bristol Bay. Accurate grading, more high quality fish, a longer lasting product, and community-oriented employment in some of the more remote corners of the region. Glob builds with the future in mind. He introduces me to his son-in-law, and I look around and notice that except for Glob, there's no one over 30 at work on this project.
I often ended up with 15 or 20 people in their 20s who were just coming into the work world in their lives looking for a career instead of just a way to keep their hands busy.
If this pilot project is successful, he and Blakey plan to build at least three more processing barges, brand new from scratch, in Sitka's industrial park. Each will cost around $5 million. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And a correction. In a story we aired Wednesday about a cut to the permanent fund dividends, we overstated the amount Ben Nikuschik's household would lose. It would be a drop of nearly $11,000, not $13,000. That is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, Teresa Kotsarilis in Bethel, Nora Sachs in Petersburg, Ed Schoenfeld, Andrew Kitchenman, and Carter Barrett in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, Ann Hillman produced tonight's show, and I am Zachariah Hughes. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to young people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided for all the training programs, providing students with housing, food, books, and tools. Learn more by calling 1-800-733-JOBS. This message sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.